Welcome to Warships Pod, and our guest this episode is Steve Kershaw, who served for 21 years in the UK's submarine service, doing operations and more in various nuclear-powered submarines and even a diesel boat. He is now consulting in defence and security, specialising in improving military programmes and procurements, and also enterprise-wide transformation. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's great to be working with you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been a long time, but this time it's on a podcast rather than some sort of corporate communications thing. As we're a naval thing, then of course, you know, we want to focus on your naval career and what you did then, maybe a few fascinating insights into your life under the sea. And of course, in your current job, you are, I believe, involved in aspects of reshaping the modern Royal Navy. So what was your path to joining the Royal Navy? Why did you join the Royal Navy? What was it got you to volunteer for the service?
Yeah, so I joined the Navy in September 1985, joined Dartmouth as a midshipman. I think it was the biggest sort of post-war intake. So that was sort of a few years after the Falcons, people were sort of rearming. And I'd seen the Falcons play out, you know, when I was at school. I was coming back from sort of school and watching it on the TV, etc. So I suppose that sort of interested me because that was a, you know, pretty formative period in my life. I was doing maths, physics and chemistry as A-levels at college. And I actually wanted to be a physicist. So I was going to go and do a degree in physics. I'm quite glad I didn't actually, because my maths, it turns out, wasn't really up to being a physicist, I suspect, in retrospect. But also it was just when parental contributions to degree courses were coming in. So hitherto they'd all been free. And my mum and dad both worked in factories, and you know, I could tell that my dad wasn't a massive fan of having to pay for me to go to university, to put it mildly. So I then started looking out for sponsorships. So I got a sponsorship to do electronic engineering at York University with BT. I actually got a place in the army. So I was going to join the Royal Signals as a bursary, because they were just bringing in the Ptarmigan electronic sort of communication system, and they were looking for lots of electronic engineers. I had a place at Sandhurst, the whole thing. And I realized at the last minute that I hated camping. And it seemed to me that, you know, being... Yeah, the army was like camping with a gun. I know I'm doing it a massive misservice. I don't know why, but I didn't really fancy the Air Force. So I thought I'll give the Navy a go. So I did, and did my regular commissions board, got a place at Dartmouth, joined. I have to say, I mean, I'm the first person in my family who's ever joined the Navy. I didn't know to tie a knot, nothing at all. I was a bit of a sort of fish out of water, to be honest. But really enjoyed my time at Dartmouth. Dartmouth training ship was on the aircraft carrier Invincible, went to the Caribbean, Fort Lauderdale, Nassau, had a great time, came back, graduated, passed out, then went to HMS Lindisfarne, which is a fish protection vessel. Some of your listeners might remember it, the Ireland class. Joined it in Duncow Quay in Blyth, just outside Newcastle. And basically went all around the UK in the sort of 5 months that I was on her, which is great fun, boarding fishing vessels, all that kind of stuff. We worked for Captain Fishery Protection, who was known on the ship as the Cod Father. And then I joined Royal Naval Engineering College Manadon to do my engineering degree. And the setup there was everybody did a common first year, and at the end of the first 2 years, at the end of the second year, you had to specialise. You could either be an air engineer, a weapon engineer, surface or submarine, or marine engineer, surface or submarine. And the air engineer bit was a bit of a closed community. It was only about four or five of them every year, and you had to have shown a deep interest in doing that in order to be selected, which I hadn't done. And I remember on, it was when Hunt for Red October came out, so read that. It was a time in which I think submariners, it's fair to say, were sort of ruling the roost in the Navy, you know, Commander-in-Chief Fleet, First Sea Lord, all submariners. They were the Navy's capital ships. And, you know, that's where the sort of front line was, it seemed to me. And my sort of group of friends, we all persuaded each other that we should probably join submarines. And the thing that really flipped it for me, having sort of been on a couple of visits, was, so I wanted to be a weapon engineer. And the weapon engineer on a submarine had a much more operational role in the submarine than did on a surface ship. And I don't mean to demean in any way surface ship weapon engineers, because they're obviously doing a valuable job. But on a submarine, you're watch keeping on the periscope, you're doing navigation, you're on ship control, you're on the ops, you fire all the weapons. It was much more hands-on, it seemed to me, and that really appealed. So I put down on my, you put three preferences. So everybody put air engineering down as their third preference because they knew they weren't going to get it. So it's like tactical voting. I'm definitely going to get one of my first two. And I actually put weapon engineer submariner down as my first choice and marine engineer submariner down as my second choice. I wanted to be a submariner so much that I would have rather have been a marine engineer on submarines than a weapon engineer on a surface ship. So I got my first choice. And then did my weapons application training and then joined HMS Dolphin to do my submarine training down in Gosport when that was still a thing. You know, the submarine escape tank and all that kind of stuff. Did the basic warfare course, did the nuclear general course, which is the sort of noddy and big ears go to nuclear land course that all the seaman officers and weapon engineers did at Greenwich. And then joined my first boat, which was HMS Talent. So that's how I got into submarines.
So it wasn't due to any watching John Mills in films, but rather Sean Connery is to blame. If
that's
you
right.
Call
yeah.
Blame.
Yeah. Once yeah. more, we play our dangerous game.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's what got me in.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Shows you, doesn't it? So the Navy at the time was obviously much bigger than it is today. And as you said, it was coming back from a bit of a regeneration, well, not back from it, but was undergoing a regeneration post the Falklands. And your first submarine, you went to HMS London, which is an anti-submarine warfare frigate.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, did you do anything interesting in that ship?
We a bit. So it was being driven by a great guy, Captain Jim Taylor, who was a submariner, who went on to be, as a Commodore, the sort of chief of staff to FOSSUM. And so it was...
That's Flag Officer the Submarines, isn't it? Flag Officer Submarines.
Yeah, that's FOSSUM. Right, yeah. And you'll know there was a pretty strong track record of putting ex-submariners as captains of the Type 22s, you know, because they were submarine hunting ships. So that was great fun. I mean, we were part of a big JMC, which is Joint Maritime Congress, a big exercise with submarines and aircraft and what have you. And I remember we spent about, it must have been a good 5 weeks going round and round Rockall, which is a sort of like desolate, you know, island in the North Atlantic, not really finding very much. It's actually quite dull, I seem to remember. But I enjoyed my time on London tremendously. And I remember when I left, I was about to go and do my submarine training, and Jim Taylor, God bless him, he sort of read out my report and said, and I put down here, Steve, you are thoroughly recommended to join the submarine service. And he said, and that's from the guy that's going to run it. And I thought, good. I think that's a good endorsement.
yeah, brilliant. And I mean, I seem to remember HMS London in that period, if you're talking the end of the 80s, that was the time she went up to the Barents Sea when he was in command. And,
that's right.
I tried just, to get yeah, away with stealing a Russian torpedo. Were you on board?
Yeah, yeah. Good memory. I joined just after that, unfortunately. So there was still lots of chat about that because it was a pretty, you know, something they were really proud of doing. The interesting thing that did happen when I was on HMS London is we had a ship's visit to Wilhelmshaven, and the weapon engineer on board, a guy called Tony Dutter. He'd been on staff course with an army guy who was posted out to Berlin. And he'd arranged for about four or five of us to travel to Berlin, which at the time you had to go through East Germany. You got a train at Hanover Station. You got into Berlin, and then we stayed at the officers' mess near the Olympic Stadium. And I was under strict instructions from a number of people, because the captain came with us, Jim Taylor. And of course, he really had like clearances, you know, up to his eyeballs for various things. Like, on no account are you allow the captain to go over into East Germany, you know, East Berlin and whatever. And but that was the weekend that the war came down. So we were there at the time, you know, when they pulled the wall down and all the Trabants came through. I remember sort of like, you know, walking around Berlin, and I had a piece of the Berlin Wall in my pocket, in my Barler pocket. And we had quite a lot to drink, I'm not going to lie. I remember sitting in a bar and looking at this bit of concrete which had some red paint sprayed over it. I thought, I'm not going to carry that around for the next day. So I just left it on the floor in this bar. That was the closest I came to a new piece of the Berlin Wall. There you go.
Did you regret leaving it on the floor of the bar?
I did.
Yeah, never mind. Yeah.
But it was an amazing time, though. I remember we were sitting in a bar, and obviously Jim Taylor had been a proper Cold War warrior, a driven Spartan, I think, and obviously he'd done the things that you just mentioned. We're all sitting there thinking, what happens now? When we really didn't know what was going to happen.
And so what happened to you was you went and did your submarine training, some of which you referred to. But then when were you sent, drafted to, you know, be the crew or part of the crew? I mean, I suppose the training carried on while you joined, after you joined a boat, didn't it?
Yeah, so as you'll know, you join your submarine as a what they call a Part 3 trainee. So you do your Part 1 and 2 training at Dolphin and various other places. And I joined as the assistant weapon engineer officer. So on a Trafalgar class, you've got a weapon engineer officer who's a lieutenant commander, the deputy who's a lieutenant, and then the Part 3 trainee, as I was the assistant weapon engineer officer. So I joined Talon just after she'd been built and done work up. And then very quickly, the first Gulf War happened. And we were basically, so I did a bit, we did a bit of work up, and then we basically got deployed. We sort of dived off Plymouth and spent all of our time in the Eastern Mediterranean. And we surfaced off Gibraltar 13 weeks later. So my first sort of trip, if you like, was the longest trip I actually ever did, which was 13 weeks. And again, that's, you know, like all long patrols, it had its moments of excitement. And in the main, it was, you know, sort of, you know, just at periscope depth, surveying stuff most of the time. I remember, because it was all very covert, we did a dive transit of the Gibraltar Straits. So that was pretty cool. And the briefing that we did before we went through in the wardroom, you know, there's a navigator saying this is the, because I mean the Straits of Gibraltar are pretty deep, so it's fine. You can go underneath all the traffic, but you still need to, you know, do it carefully. And just before the brief, the first lieutenant, a great guy called John Edgell, played the bit of Das Boot, which I'm sure you're aware of, where they say, you know, the British are here and they did a dive transit through the Straits of Gibraltar. So
they tried to, anyway, didn't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they sadly got bombed and sank and stuff. Yeah. But that sort of set the scene for it, really. And then we went into the Mediterranean and we sort of moved around the Eastern Med, sort of looking after. We didn't really know whether Libya was going to start interdicting the armour that was going through. And you might remember Gaddafi called the line of death across the Gulf of Sirte, across the line, I'll kill you, and all that kind of stuff. So we were basically sort of making sure that, you know, if the bad guys came out, we were gonna follow them and keep tabs on them. So that's what we did. And then we surfaced up Gibraltar 13 weeks later. And interestingly, I qualified. So that during the 13 weeks, I got my Dolphin. So when we arrived in Gibraltar, first thing that happened is, as is tradition, I had to sort of like drink a glass of rum with my Dolphins at the bottom of the glass, catch them in my teeth. And then they say, well, congratulations, Steve, you're the officer of the day. Because I was the new promoted guy, everybody else went ashore, and I had to look after the submarine on the first day, which is fair, I suppose. And then, enjoyed my first bit of fresh air, nice food, and a drink for 13 weeks.
Did that, the 13 weeks, I've spoken to various people and, you know, I did a 3-day trip in Trafalgar class and a day, you know, under the sea. So I don't know anything. I'm just a landlubber. But in talking to people, like I remember the XO of Triumph in the late 90s,
oh, yeah.
He was telling me how, and I quoted him about this in the piece I did on the voyage. He said that when you spend a certain amount of time on board a submarine, your vision shortens.
I've heard that. I never experienced it directly. I mean, the main one when you, because you do 6 hours on, 6 hours off continuously, that's pretty tiring. You never really get a long sleep. So the main impact I always found in coming back from, you know, I did quite a lot of patrols, and there were generally, certainly on nuclear boats, between 8 and 10 weeks in the main. You come back and it just take you for ages to get your circadian rhythm to adapt to natural life. You know, you're waking up at 1 in the morning for like the first week, which is pretty unhelpful. Yeah, so that was the main sort of side effect, if you like, of what I found being underwater for long periods of time. The other one was whether or not you gain weight or lost weight. People tended to do one or the other, it seemed to me, because it can be quite sedentary if you're sat in front of a sonar, or you're sat in front of a panel, whether it's a nuclear, you know, the nuclear plant panel, or it's a ship control panel. But I was mainly pretty active, so I was walking around periscopes and what have you, and then I used to sort of go on the rowing machine as a bit of exercise as well. And weight used to drop off me. I'd come back and I'm like, you know, none of my clothes fitted, which wasn't a great look when you come back. You're really pale.
Yeah.
You keep waking up at odd times of the day and night. You're tired and none of your clothes fit you. But apart from that, it was great.
Yeah. You didn't get that bit. Somebody told me that you didn't get the bit where you the air in the submarine is so much purer than the outside air that when you go up and experience the outside world again for the first time, you think it stinks. I mean, you didn't.
Well, no, I didn't see that, but I did have the exact opposite experience when I was on Unicorn, which was a diesel boat, which you might want to come on to.
We will come to that,
Yeah. I can talk about that if you like.
Yeah, no, that's a whole different world, isn't it? So your next submarine was which submarine? Because I know you moved on to another Trafalgar
class. So having qualified, I did my DWEOS course, I think. And I remember I was due to join HMS Turbulent, and which I eventually did. But I got a phone call from the Squadron Weapon Engineer Officer saying, "Steve, the DWEO of Torbay needs to have a shoulder operation." And I can't remember his exact words. I don't think he gave me a choice. I'm pretty sure about that. He said, "So you're going to join on the 1st of October." To take over for him while he's in hospital. First thing I said was, "Do I get a run ashore, sir?" And he said, "No." So Torbay was one of the two special fit boats at the time. So as you know, the submarine service has got two, and she was going on a special fit mission. So I joined her, and we got back on, I think it was the 19th of December. So it's just before Christmas. That was a real eye opener for me, because I'd not really been in that world before. So lots of interactions with other units, etc. I mean, you've written about this in your book.
Yeah. I was going to say, without drawing you into saying anything, you just explained to listeners who don't know, without drawing you into saying anything, you're not allowed to say or whatever. Special fit is the particular submarines that had the, should we just simplify it, comms and sensors, whatever, to enable them to go up into the high north and then surveil the Russians and what they were up to. But what year was this? I mean, were the Russians still up to things?
Oh, yeah, they were still very active. So this is the thing about, you know, when we were sat in the pub with Jim Taylor saying what happens next after the Berlin Wall came down, whilst there was, you know, you had the Yeltsin era, the Gorbachev, Yeltsin, Putin era, you know, some things never really stopped, you know, and the submarine activity, sort of aggressive Russian submarine activity and submarine development, which we're seeing today. I mean, they never stopped developing. So they obviously think it's a very important capability. They were still pretty active. I mean, you know, some of their older boats that they might have kept running, they didn't, because they were stuck for resources. But, you know, their newer boats, so, you know, the Victor 3s, the Akulas, the Sierras, all that kind of stuff, they were still around.
Yeah, so you went up aboard HMS Torbay and did that. I mean, and then after that, you got back and you were the Deputy Weapons Engineer Officer. That's what DWEO means. So were you?
That's right, yeah. On Torbay and then Turbulent.
Yeah. So you then went to Turbulent. And these are all Trafalgar-class submarines.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I served on Talent, Torbay, Turbulent, Tallent and Torbay again several times when I was I joined a thing called Naval Sea Trials Party 30, which is as an acoustic intelligence rider, which I'm happy to talk about. And then my final boat was Tylos. So out of the seven T boats, I was on four of them, and some of them several times.
Was that because they couldn't find anybody with your particular skill set, or who was available to go? And so there was only a few of you. I mean, comparatively.
I don't really know. I mean, I had a fairly strange career for a weapon engineer officer in which all of my time as a lieutenant and a lieutenant commander, apart from 1 year where I did an MSc, a Master of Science at Shrivenham, it was all on submarines. I mean, normally you do one job as a DUEO, Deputy Weapon Engineer Officer, and then 8 years later you'll do another one as a Weapon Engineer Officer. I didn't, for whatever reason, I didn't do that. So I when I finished on Turbulen, I was very keen to get a job on an SSK, so the conventional submarine. So we had the four upholders. And that was for a couple of reasons. So one, I really liked operations. Yeah, that was stuff I liked doing. I'd also done a submarine acquaint course on one of the old Oberon class HMS Onslaught for a week running out of Gosport. And that was like being on Das Boot. I mean, it was quite World War II-ish, with you being in the control room on the periscope, where people walking past with their dinner going to the aftermess type stuff, which is a bit of an eye opener. So I'm really keen on being on a diesel boat. So I volunteered for that. I became the weapon engineer officer of HMS Unicorn, which is still in service with the Canadians. It's now called Her Majesty's Canadian Submarine Victoria. And I joined as a weapon engineer officer on my 25th birthday. So I joined on that day. And captain was John Gower, God bless him. He sadly passed away recently. And we were, my first day was in the attack teacher doing weapons certification, like firing weapons with people, assessing me and scrutinizing me and all that kind of stuff.
And this was ashore, you say the attack teacher, that's a simulator, yeah.
Yeah, this was down in Devonport, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we finished our weapons certification by going up to, we went to Stavanger and did, because she'd just been built, so I missed the build and the initial bit of workup. But we then did the weapon systems calibration at Stavanger, came back down, did our weapon certification in on the Butte range, firing Tigerfish and Harpoon, Tigerfish torpedoes at the time, then came back down to Plymouth. And then we set off for this big deployment, and we went, we were away for about 7 months, I think it was. We went all the way through the Med, through the Suez Canal, Red Sea, into the Gulf, did some stuff in the Gulf, came back down, went down to Diego Garcia, which is a long way away, particularly on a diesel boat when you're averaging about 8 knots and you've got a couple of thousand miles of the Indian Ocean to go. Spent a couple of weeks in Diego Garcia doing a maintenance period, then came back up into Karachi, back into the Gulf, did some more stuff in the Gulf, and came all the way back round, called into Jeddah in Saudi Arabia in the Red Sea, called into Rhodes in the Mediterranean, and then came back to Plymouth. So, I mean, that was great fun. Great fun. I mean, my time on Unicorn was probably the best job I had in the Navy, I think.
So what was the... sorry to interrupt, but I mean, just to put the context here. So... we had the four U-class, the upholder-class submarines. I mean,
yep.
I only ever visited one, I think it was Ursula, alongside Devonport. So I, never experienced one that was afloat, but, not at sea, not even in the Sound. So they were, when HMS Dolphin was closed as the submarine base for diesel-electric submarines and in the 90s, they were switched to join the 2nd Submarine Squadron or be part of that setup.
That's Devonport. Right. Yep.
But then fairly soon, the Axe was suspended over them due to, I think, was it Options for Change, the defence cut?
Yeah, that happened whilst we were on board. Yeah,
right.
We found
oh,
out
I see.
That the class was being decommissioned.
Right,
yeah.
Right. What, you mean the decision to get rid of them, you mean?
Yeah.
So when you set off on that journey, the different maybe mindset on the way back in terms of, being in a diesel-electric submarine, but what was... I mean, it's a very, very long way. It's a marathon voyage And as you said, in most of it on the surface, presumably, very slow. So, you know, what was the objective of sending a diesel boat? Was it to try out a diesel boat in the Gulf, which is notoriously, an area where nuclear submarines try not to operate. So what was the point in sending, was that the point of sending the Unicorn?
Yeah, I think it was a couple of things. So one was a sort of flying the flag thing. So we going to Diego Garcia, it's important that we have, periodic visits there. So that was why we ended up going there. There were a number of really large exercises that took place in the Gulf, where we were simulating an Iranian Kilo class submarine. So having a diesel electric submarine in the Gulf so that the US forces, the UK forces could basically practice and like war game. There was an American 688 Los Angeles class submarine out there as well. And we were the sort of like mouse and they were all the cats type stuff. So we simulated an Iranian diesel submarine out there. So that was pretty important. There were two big exercises that we did that. We did a patrol and we did two patrols in the Gulf as well. So it's sort of re-establishing that sort of presence of diesel electric submarines in the region. It was interesting because the Apollo-class had been designed to basically operate in the North Atlantic, in the Greenland, Iceland, UK gap, really capable boats. I mean, towed array. It was like being on a mini Trafalgar-class in some ways. Some of the systems were similar. They had the same weapons. In fact, in some ways, they were the next generation of technology ahead. So we had air turbine pumps instead of water round discharge, for example, which is much more flexible, quieter, smaller, what have you. But it still had some of that diesel boat characteristics. I mean, it had two decks, which is sort of different from an Apollo class. So it was a bit bigger. It's from an Oberon class, it's a bit bigger. But then, you know, there was still 55 blokes crammed into a pretty small space. It was pretty tiny. And you did smell a lot by the time you got back because the sort of diesel gets into everywhere. On a nuclear boat, you can have a shower most days. You know, it was really frowned upon having a shower on a diesel boat. And in fact, we did one patrol, coming back to my smelly point I made earlier, where we did about 3 weeks in the Gulf. And the day after we dived, we came out of Dubai, the reverse osmosis plant stopped working. Now, the reverse osmosis plant takes in seawater and you put it through a permeable membrane and it generates fresh water. And we didn't have very big fresh water tanks because we had a reverse osmosis plant. And when that stopped working on day one, we put all of the heads and bathrooms, as we call them, all the toilets, all the sinks, out of action. That was it for 3 weeks. And the Gulf at the time was about 34 degrees C. That was the temperature of the water. And that's basically the heat sink for a diesel boat. So it doesn't really ever get any colder than that. And then you run the diesels and it gets hotter. So we're all like in shorts and T-shirts and, you know, it's pretty uncomfortable. And I remember going up to the, we surfaced eventually. We got all this like green seaweed had grown all over the conning tower while we'd been dug. We've been at periscope deck pretty much the whole time. So it sort of stank like some kind of like dead pet shop. I remember being up there with a navigator thinking, God, this is smelly. And then I went back down to the boat and thought, oh my God, this is even smellier.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to ask a question here because this sounds like something going back to British submarines in the Dardanelles or the North Sea in World War One. So I have to ask the question, if the heads were out, you know, the toilets were out and you couldn't use the sinks. I mean, there's obviously the stink of the body odour. But I mean, what happened if you were dived all the time, particularly because you wouldn't even be an E-boat, A-class boat in World War One.
Oh, you were still allowed to use the toilets.
Oh, you were still allowed to use the toilet. I thought you might have done what they did, which would have buckets of it and you have to chuck it over
the side. No, it's fine. The toilets were flushed using seawater.
I misunderstood.
What I meant was the showers and the sinks.
Yeah, I did think it was more horrific than perhaps it was, but it sounds pretty...
not quite.
Yeah, it sounds pretty uncongenial. Anyway.
Yeah, and I remember we got into Abu Dhabi, I think it was. And the squadron weapon engineer officer came out to sort of visit us. And I very cunningly packed all of my civvies in hermetically sealed plastic bags. So they were sort of impervious to the pong, if you like. And I thought, I'm not putting these on because I need a wash. I mean, I've been living in this thing for sort of like getting on for 4 weeks. It's pretty dirty. And the squadron weapon engineer said, well, I'll give you a lift to the hotel, Steve, if you like. So I was like, oh, great. That's really good. Thanks, sir. So he drove, so I didn't get changed, got into the car, and he drove me there with his head out the window like a Labrador the whole way because I smelled so badly. So, then checked into the hotel and had a really very welcome shower.
Yeah, when you tried to check in, did they hold their noses?
No? Oh, yeah, they weren't very happy when a bloke that looked like Catweasel was trying to check into their posh hotel.
Excellent, yeah. It just sounds like, what do they call them? Dirty boats, you know. That's what they call them. Yeah, that just sounds like what they were.
Yeah. But it was great fun, though.
Yeah. So, as a weapon engineer, having to run sophisticated systems, presumably with, to simplify it, you might have said this to me, or you might have said it already on this podcast. Sorry, I lost track there. But an Apollo class boat was, let's say, a diesel boat at the back bit, it was like a Trafalgar class, you know, boat at the front, maybe with all the weaponry. How did you mitigate for the power that would need at the front end for maybe keeping everybody alive and everything running in the other parts of the submarine?
Well, I think it's got a pretty big battery, so it's fine. One of the things that surprised me about diesel boats was how hard you had to work the battery. So I don't know why I had this impression that you go for like 3 or 4 days and you were fine without having to charge. But we were charging every day. Now, a lot of that was because we were transiting. So because it was so hot in the Gulf and the Indian Ocean, what we used to do was be underwater during the day. We'd come up and put them, bear in mind, we were probably doing about 12 knots or something, which drains the battery reasonably quickly. We put a snort on at lunchtime, and then we go again, and then we'd surface in the evening and run on the surface charging the battery, and then dive in the morning, and we sort of did that. So we were charging it quite a bit. But then when we were doing this exercise where we're simulating an Iranian keyline and we were stooging around at quite low speeds, the battery lasts quite a long time, and I can tell you they had a hell of a job finding it. Including the Los Angeles class submarine as well. And meanwhile, we were able to sort of like pick off merchant vessels that we didn't actually shoot them, but we pretended that we did.
No.
And we were sinking everything, and it was great fun.
Yeah. So on the way back, or while you're out there, you hear that the SSKs, the diesels, are going to be axed. So how did that affect people? Did they then feel rather disillusioned by it or not?
Yes, they did. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I found when I joined diesel boats is actually there were sort of subsets of the submarine service. There was the diesel lot. So most of the ship's company, joined in Gosport, lived in Gosport, and went from one diesel boat to another one. And then, of course, you've got the bombers, the ballistic missile firing submarines up in Scotland, and a lot of people, make their life on bombers. And then you've got the hunter killers, which were in Devonport and Faz Lane. So you had these like three joined but also sort of separate communities. When they moved the Apollo class from Portsmouth to Plymouth, quite a lot of the people lived in Plymouth moved to Plymouth. Because that was where their future lay. So there were quite a few pretty disgruntled people. It was like, I've just moved my family to Plymouth, and they've decommissioned the boats. And they've been on diesel boats, all their lives. So they were wondering, shall I leave now? Will I get retrained and go onto nuclear boats? So it was really disappointing. This was such a great submarine, and we had great results in these exercises and all the rest of it. And I think I'm right in saying like 38,000 miles on the clock when we decommissioned her, because she was the latest of the four. So pretty new. And we kept her looking like new as well, because we had a great deal of pride in it. So we came back into Plymouth having been away for 7 months, and kind of that was that.
Yeah.
It was a few people left. I left, went on to do something else. And then she was sort of driven up to Barrow and decommissioned.
Yeah, somewhere in the archives I've got, because I was doing defence reporting and stuff at that time, I worked with a photographer who I think got photographs of that submarine coming back, actually somewhere. There was a print of that. So it was the end of a long, long time in the Royal Navy of diesel submarines. So that was the end of a chapter in history. So for you, the next chapter was what? What was the next chapter?
So what happened then was I was volunteered to join this Naval Sea Trials Party 30, which is the acoustic intelligence sea riders. So on these special fit boats that we talked about earlier, you had a community that did the above water intelligence gathering and a community that did the below water intelligence gathering. And that was generally two officers, a seaman officer and a weapon engineer, that would sit in the same room with the same room crew and operate the special fit sonar, which had a sort of like enhanced capability. It's like the Formula One of sonar, if you like. So I did that for about 2.5 years. So I basically went from one patrol on a special fit boat, came back, helped with the analysis, and then did the next one. I think I did 5 patrols during that time. So it was pretty intensive sort of sea time for me.
Yeah, I was lucky enough, and in some ways I don't know why, but I was, I think because I wrote a book called Hunter Killers about the Cold War Royal Navy Submarine Service. But I was invited to the, I think it was the Diamond Anniversary of that unit in about 10 years ago. And
I was at that with you. It was in Collingwood, wasn't it? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Was it you that got
me invited? I remember seeing you there.
It was you.
It wasn't me. I would never get you invited to that.
Yeah, but so I didn't know you were there. You see, I'm getting old. My memory's going. Right. So in Collingwood. Exactly. Yeah. So I was there and I've got a very nice challenge coin with a skull and crossbones on it. And
I've still got it. Yeah,
I've got it on a shelf here. Sorry, Steve. What an insult to you. I forgot you.
That's all right.
So I was invited to that, which was, I was quite surprised at, because I don't think I was even aware that it existed. So as much as I understood of it, because it was a different era from when you were involved, maybe, I don't know. It was that case of these people going from submarine to submarine, spending a bit of time in like nomads in some ways, and then doing whatever they did, which I didn't, you know, I wasn't privy to. But it did sound like quite a remarkable little unit. So, I mean, was it something that meant you were clocking up the air miles?
Well, submarine miles, definitely not so much air miles. So I had to do the advanced acoustic analysis course, which is what all the chief ops sonars do when the flight sergeants that operated the Nimrod Sonoboy stuff and will now be doing the, you know, the P8 thing. So these are the top people in the same room. The sort of highest qualification is they call it the AAA course, the Advanced Acoustic Analysis course. Of course, they've got, you know, 20 years of experience of looking at, you know, sonars. I basically had none. I mean, before that, you know, I was responsible for their maintenance and availability. I used to sort of stick my head in and say, how's it going, fellas, and show a bit of interest. So now I was sort of like thrown in at the deep end and had to sort of pass this course. And then I was out sitting in the same room looking at the special fit sonars, and I worked hand in glove with the same room team. It was a really fascinating job, I have to say, and it was really formative as well, and it sort of affects the way I think about military capability to a certain extent even today. So we come back from a patrol, and I'd been operating this sort of stuff, and I go, and we had some scientists that worked with us at Farnborough. It was the Anti-Submarine Warfare Data Analysis Centre. It used to be at Farnborough. I don't know where it is now. And that was where all the records that were kept from submarine patrols and RAF Sonoboy patrols all came back into this sort of central repository and were analysed and what have you. And sometimes we'd find, you know, new things to look at and look out for. And we'd basically say, well, I want to develop something that looks at that. And then when I come back from my next patrol, it was ready. It was sort of fitted, you know. And so we had this really sort of agile development, which is why I called it the sort of Formula One of sonar. So whereas the sort of standard sonars that we had, you know, on team boats, we had 2020 and 2046 were the main ones. They got upgraded every, you know, 4 to 6 years or something. You get the odd software upgrade, but you know, if you were going to do like a big upgrade, it would be, you know, years in between them. We'd be upgrading them every 3 months, you know. So when we found something and, oh, that's interesting, we need to optimize this or create a new application to look at it, we do that in weeks. And that's, you know, that's what warfare is like now. You know, everybody's doing that all over the place. That's what Ukraine are doing. So it was quite an interesting sort of insight into that world for me.
But isn't that the thing that is very interesting, without digressing too much at this stage, because we're going to talk about the future Navy at the end. Sure. But that is a clear case of, this job is important, we must have it, therefore. And it's the same with the Ukrainians. Obviously, they're fighting for their existence, and therefore it happens almost immediately or as soon as you can. Whereas for too long, where we are now with the UK armed forces is that there isn't, despite what politicians say, there isn't quite that urgency. Although I know you're going to talk about the hybrid Navy in a moment. So, yeah, so it's very interesting that your area then was getting that priority.
Yeah, and I think the most important thing I learned from that is the, you know, innovation, and you know, there's a lot of innovation at the frontline commands in the UK armed forces. The real innovation is done by the frontline commands, the war fighters, the people at the frontline, because they're seeing it day to day. That's not to say that some technical innovation, that a new thing is invented and that can have real application in wartime, you know, can't be introduced in a strategic program. That's still important. But getting the warfighter to be able to sort of, you know, rapidly update, you know, what they're using is vital. I mean, special forces have been doing that for a while. I'm not saying I was special forces, but we were sort of fairly elite unit that was doing a special job, and we had quite a lot of resources to help us do that and to innovate and, you know, iterate the capability. And I think that's an increasingly important aspect of warfare these days.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll come back to that in a second. But just to
sure.
to get your naval career wound up, so we can move on to the that sort of
yeah.
chat to conclude. Right. So I do recall because you and I first met when I was between editions of Warships IFR, helping to write a thing called. Well, the script for a thing called the Royal Navy Presentation Team. And so a recent event in my head prior to that was the HMS Tireless holiday at Gibraltar. So there may not be a huge amount you could say about it, but that basically it was a Trafalgar-class submarine that made headlines because it had a problem with the reactor system and had to pause at Gibraltar. So how did you come to be in that submarine at that time, early 2000s?
Yes. So so when I finished this job at NSTP 30, I then did an MSc at Shrivenham, which is the only time in my time as a lieutenant and lieutenant commander I wasn't on a submarine, basically. I then joined HMS Torbay, which is in refit. She was getting the new 2076 sonar system fitted, upgraded to the combat system, the reactor refuel. So I was on her for a year. And then I joined HMS Tireless as a weapon engineer officer. So great. And we were part of Naval Task Group 2000, which was going to go around the world. And I was really looking forward to it because there were two things that I'd not managed to tick off in the submarine task book of life. So I'd done sort of under ice stuff. I'd been in, you know, I've mentioned Indian Ocean, Gulf, been through Suez a bunch of times, Mediterranean quite a lot. So I'd done most things. Hadn't been through Panama, hadn't been in the Pacific. And because we were going to go around the world, I think we were going to go to Dubai, Singapore, Japan, Hawaii, through Panama, stop at Nassau. So it was all the things I hadn't done was going to tick off. And so that was pretty exciting. Unfortunately, we didn't make it out of the Mediterranean. So as you said, we had a leak on the reactor, which caused us to turn around. We hadn't gone through Suez. So to remember, we were, you know, I remember very clearly being in the wardroom. So I was in the first watch, so the captain and the first lieutenant, eight, first sitting. And I sat there and there was a phone call from the marine engineer officer. And he gave it to, he said, is the assistant marine officer reactor there? And he was actually sat on the right, guy called Shades Freeman. And I gave him the, I said, yeah, he's here. And he just went, yeah, oh, right, boss, yeah, yeah, okay. And he gave me the phone back, completely deadpan, saying, would you excuse me, please, gentlemen? There appears to be a leak on the reactor. Stood up and walked off,
right.
Put his overalls on.
Yeah.
And I mean, just cutting to the chase, we were all safe. You know,
yes.
There was no danger of meltdown. Yeah. It was repaired, all that kind of stuff.
Because people might have had visions there of like K-19 or something, but
Exactly. It wasn't that. But it was significant, and it was so significant that we basically turned around and went back. And the intention was we go back to the UK, get repaired, and we might have even rejoined the naval task group. But it turned out that actually we needed significant repairs, so we went into Gibraltar, and the boat was there for a year. Mm. I mean, it took a year to repair it. Mm. I was there for the first 6 months, and then was lucky enough to get promoted to commander, and then left. So I didn't do the whole stint. But pretty disappointing. You know, the trip for us was cancelled. I remember HMS Triumph came in to, she took over our running. So after a couple of months, it was decided, right, you're not gonna catch them up. We need to put another submarine in there. So Triumph came in, and because we got special periscopes because of some of the stuff we were going to be doing, we had to swap over the periscopes between us and Triumph, and there were some of the stores that we gave them and all the rest of it. And I remember she went off into the distance. I watched a sail and thinking, wish I was going with that. So that was my last submarine, unfortunately. I didn't join anymore after Talos.
Incredible to be in so many submarines and be at sea so often, though. I mean, that's extraordinary, isn't it?
None of it was planned, Ian. It just seemed to happen.
I mean, without digressing too much into it, I mean, when you think of where we are today and trying to inspire people to join the submarine service, which is not an easy life, then, you know, your career, without making you feel too big-headed about it, is a sort of exemplary, career in terms of being so active from, you know, whether in surface ships or, and, you know, activity and giving people things to do is very important, isn't it? Young people especially, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, interesting places to visit is also quite important. I was quite lucky in that regard too.
Yeah. So you almost saw the entire world in your
almost.
Almost, yeah.
Yeah.
As I referred to earlier, I first met you when I was doing that Between Magazines script writing job on the Royal Navy presentation team. Which is not, you know, it's probably not that exciting in terms of talking about here, at least within the context of what we're discussing. But I mean, they therefore decided that you, as somebody with that career, was somebody and with that experience, was worth working with a writer like me. And I know that your job was to liaise with all the various people having input to that script in the Navy and the MOD. And you were one of several I worked with because I did it for a few years. So was that considered to be, something that in those days, it was to explain to people. So, and I don't know if it's still running, but it was a multimedia presentation that toured the country and I think maybe did other places as well, maybe overseas occasionally. I don't know. You have to tell me. And it basically got together a few hundred people in various locations and had a couple of charismatic presenters and then did a multimedia show and then took a Q&A from each audience. So it was a major thing for the Royal Navy at that time, like 20 odd years ago.
That's right. And I, and to be clear, I wasn't one of the charismatic presenters.
Oh, I think so, you could have done it, Steve, but no, you weren't.
you and I wrote the script and got it all approved and the multimedia show, and then we handed it over to the Royal Navy presentation scene, which I don't know if it's running either or not. But at the time, it was seen as a very useful communication tool to get the message of what the Navy was doing, how important it was, what its plans were, out into the public domain. So they used to go to sort of golf clubs and churches and Boy Scouts and, you know, municipal gatherings all around the country to sort of spread the word.
And according to the internet, as I've used Professor Google, it does exist. It does still run. I mean, it is a good idea because it's human contact. It's somebody putting a face to it and getting to meet people. Because the team itself, of course, is composed of, you know, different people in different ranks and different types, isn't it?
And it's, I suppose it's even more important these days where, you know, people select what news they listen to much more, don't they?
Yeah.
From sort of streaming and social media. So it's more, in some ways, it's easier through TikTok or whatever to get, you know, communications out to a wider audience. But if you want to tell people a long message about what you're doing and what you're up to, then I think it's a very useful medium to do that. So I only did that for about 5 months, wasn't it, I think? And it was, I left Tireless, joined the Naval Presentation Team, worked with you, and then went on staff course. So I did, it's called the Advanced Commander Staff Course. I did number 5, and I think they're on about number 30 or something now. It shows how old I am. But that was on day 2 of the course, 9/11 happened, which sort of dominated proceedings, as you can imagine, for the rest of the year, because obviously that was a seismic geopolitical event. So that shaped quite a lot of the rest of my career, really.
And so, moving on to the final bit of our chat.
Yes,
is something you said to me when we were exchanging emails, which has obviously piqued my interest because it's very current. You mentioned that one of the things you're working on at the moment, or consulting on rather, is the hybrid Navy. And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, and you were talking about innovation and delivering solutions. So in your current job, and it's okay to mention who it's for, obviously, you are helping the Royal Navy. I mean, what is your job now? How do you function with helping the Navy or whoever your client is?
Yeah. So when I left the Navy after 21 years, so I left as I've been an integrated project team leader at Abbey Wood doing procurement. So I ran the Navy's Gunnery and Electronic Warfare program. I've ended up in PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is one of the big four consultancies. I'm now actually our global defence leader, so I look after our global defence business, which I really enjoy. I also do, you know, my day job is working in the UK. When we're doing, you know, a number of different activities supporting, you know, a number of different areas of the MOD, we are helping the Navy, mainly on the sort of like commercial side of it and some of the sort of planning. But I think it's a super interesting topic, the hybrid Navy. And there's some really great thinking that's gone into it by the hierarchy of the Navy. Because, you know, we mentioned the way in which warfare has changed, you know, the lessons of Ukraine. I mean, you'll have heard people say, you know, the Ukraine have neutralized the Russian Black Sea Fleet without actually having a navy, which is, you know, incredible. I mean, whether that's true or not, but certainly you're seeing the effectiveness of maritime drones and autonomous vehicles. It just seems to me that I think the Navy's done a great job in sort of like grasping, you know, the moment. There's still a long way to go, but it seems to me that a hybrid Navy solves a number of current problems. So, I mean, let's talk about it. So one is like capability. So there's the Type 26, which is the new anti-submarine warfare frigate, which is, you know, world leading. I mean, it's not in service yet, but we've already had Australia, Canada and Norway put in orders for it. So it must be pretty good. You know, I think the UK is probably the world leader in anti-submarine warfare. Yeah, I think it's fair to say. You've then got the Astute-class submarine, which took over from the Trafalgar-class submarine. Again, amazingly capable. The problem is we don't have that many of them, you know, because they're expensive. You know, people call them exquisite capabilities. And if you're going to, you know, so you need sort of mass. So if you're going to detect all the Russian submarines that might come through the Greenland, Iceland, UK gap, you probably need more than we've got. Now, you've obviously got allies as well. But the hybrid Navy and the rise of drones, autonomy, AI, data, all of that stuff, which is all real now. It's not a concept. It's actually, you know, the technology is here. Harnessing that puts you into a different world. If you've got a Type 26, which is controlling, you know, a number of drones underwater or on the surface that are spread out, it gives you that mass, and it gives you, you know, mass for a lot cheaper than having six Type 26s. So this is a really exciting and significant development. And I think it's fair to say that the Royal Navy is sort of really leading on some of this stuff. And it's the same underwater as well. So it helps to solve the capability problem. I mean, there's a way to go yet. We're in the sort of foothills of it, but, you know, from what I've seen, I think the Navy's got some really great and exciting plans. And then you've got the crewing problem. You know, I think it's fair to say that, you know, most militaries that I see with my global defense leader hat on are struggling to recruit people. I think it's a bit mixed in the UK, but I was over in Canada recently, you know, they're like 20,000 people down on the Canadian Defence Force. They're just about to double their defence expenditure, which means they're kind of they have to nearly double their, you know, the number of soldiers, aviators, and sailors. I mean, that's a massive challenge for them, and I think most militaries are challenged by this. Now, if you move into a hybrid world, you don't need as many people that you did beforehand. So it helps solve that. And then the third thing is, it's linked to the capability point. We were talking earlier about rapid evolution of military capability. You know, in the previous world, you know, platforms were the most important thing, and the capability in the platform was so integrated. You had an anti-air destroyer like Type 45. It's basically built around the radar and the PAMS missile system. Well, actually, hybrid, you know, thinking allows you to separate some of those things. So you might have a missile ship, you might have a radar ship, you might have a command ship, and you can change the automated ships much more quickly. So you don't have to wait 6 or 12 years to do a major refit to change the system. You can actually do it in a much more agile way. So I think it solves a number of problems that, you know, armed forces are facing. It's definitely the way forward. So it's great to see the Royal Navy embrace it sort of fully, because I think it's a hugely exciting development.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that drones are, to simplify what they are going to be important, already important. But it strikes me that the stage that we're at in the evolution, it's a bit like with submarines, is the late 19th century, when you had various, let's say from the 1860s to 1880s, where you had various private enterprises, which are equivalent to the drone innovators of today, who are saying that we can do this, and we do that, and we're going to promise you this, and we can promise you that. So they are the innovators. They're in the private sector. But the thing that really brought it all together was famously, you know, John Philip Holland's submarine for the Americans. And that brought together, you know, the diesel, the petrol engine, which became the diesel engine, an actual working torpedo tube, and an actual periscope that worked, and a submarine that was all the innovations that people had talked up and didn't quite deliver for decades together in that boat. So are we at that? We're not yet at that point, though, are we, where it all comes together? And maybe this is what the hybrid Navy is, where it all knits together.
But I think the thing that is important here is you've got to get on with it and try it and iterate it. Because if you wait until it's now perfect, we can start to use it, that's like, you'll be waiting forever.
Yeah.
And we all know, you know, the threat at the moment and how imminent it could be, etc. I think we've got to get on with things, because The other thing is that the hybrid Navy is a different way of fighting. And we've got to teach ourselves how to do that and experiment and say, oh, that bit not working. Let's change that out with something else. And the technology allows you to do that pretty quickly. So I think you've if there's one thing I learned from my days in NSTP 30 is like, get on with it, give it a go. If it doesn't work, try it again. And that's long been an anathema in military procurement, you know, as you'll know, you know, with all the checks and controls and let's make sure it's perfect, et cetera. And you've clearly got to be safe and you've got to, you know, authorize and assure these systems, you know, because particularly if they're kinetic and there's, you know, there's effects at the end of them, but you've got to get on with the experimentation, I think. And I think that's something that, you know, I'm seeing being embraced, definitely.
But the human element will remain important, though, won't it, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I think that might change a bit, just in terms of the skills and the workforce that you need in order to operate this kind of stuff. Some of it won't. And there is a bit, there's clearly some thinking to be done on what does that look like. So I know that, you know, my colleagues in New Zealand are helping the New Zealand Navy think through that, because they're also embarking on, you know, hybrid stuff, because, you know, the New Zealand Navy has got a big old patch to cover, and, you know, actually having autonomous vehicles doing some of it is a really good thing for them. So they're now considering, well, what does our workforce look like? And I know the Royal Navy is as well, as are others, because it's a big shift.
Yeah. And that's, I think, something a few days ago, the new First Sea Lord, who has put a focus on, you know, sorting out problems in the submarine service, on the hybrid Navy, and also training and different ways of training. So So hopefully it'll see a resurgent and regenerated Royal Navy within a few years, do you think? Yeah,
I think that's right. The thing that worries me the most is are they going to get enough money? Because I know that, you know, the government's making some commitments, you know, 2.6% GDP by end of parliament. There's the 3.5/5% NATO commitment by 2035. Seems to me that a lot of that is back end loaded, you know, and I understand why, the fiscal constraints of the government, you know, the lack of growth and all that kind of stuff are important fiscal pressures on the government. But I do worry that there isn't enough money going into the armed forces early enough to make all these things real by the time we need them, which is pretty soon.
When you say back end loaded, how do you mean?
So if the government's commitment to get 3.5% GDP by 2035, which I'm not questioning, but if you were, you'd expect to see us going from 2.5, where we are now, to 3.5, which is a significant uptick in funding, that would be what, linear, you'd have thought, you know. But what I mean by back-end loaders, it's all going to come in 2034, 2035. Which is great, and I'm not saying that's not a good thing. But what I am saying is if you need to be able to effectively deter Russian aggression today, and in 5 years' time, and in 10 years' time, you kind of need that investment now, I think, not in 2033, 2034. That's what I mean by back end loaded.
Right. Okay. I understand, and I suppose that return to the submarine service, that's the thing that occurs to me. Although there's a lot of talk about, you know, Baron Furness and other industries that are being boosted in recruitment for welders or whatever to create the future AUKUS SSN, which is going to be a big submarine, which the Australians will build their own, but we're going to build up to 12. I mean, I'll be amazed if it's anywhere near that. But it seems to me that there are other elements. Whether it's the drones that will work with them, because there will be drones working with them, or it's the people, because you're going to need a lot of people to operate those submarines and the drones. I don't personally feel, from my own narrow insight, that there's yet attention being paid and therefore investment to the other elements, the people, whatever, being one of them, to getting that recruitment going, to getting those specialists going. I just have that feeling that it's a lot of talk about industry and going to Australia for photo opportunities and talking up. But as you say, if you don't start putting that in now, then it's not going to deliver, is it, in the 2030s and 40s?
Yeah, I think submarines, I'm reasonably confident that the money is there. I mean, it's kind of been ring-fenced, etc. And you're absolutely right. I mean, if we do build 12 AUKUS submarines, that's going to require a doubling of the submarine service. You know, the people, I mean, AUKUS will probably have fewer crew on them than the Astutes, I'm assuming, because that's the way the wind's blowing. But you're right. That's a sort of national endeavour, it seems to me. I think that's one of the, and we've heard, you know, Rich Knighton, the Chief of Defence Staff, talk about this recently, as did Tony Radakin, the Chief of Defence Staff before him, that, you know, trying to move the debate to a national level, like, you know, we're under serious threat here.
Mm.
And there seems to be, I think, a degree of sort of denial or maybe even ignorance nationally about how important this threat is to our way of life. And I think trying to move the debate into, well, it's not just the armed forces that need to step up to the plate here. This is like national resilience. And we're seeing it in lots of areas, not just in the UK, but, you know, in Europe, like drones over airfields and attacks on critical national infrastructure, whether it's cables, gas pipes, harbours. You know, these are important bits of national infrastructure, and we need to have a whole nation response. And I think upping the size of the armed forces, if that's what's needed, is going to require, you know, that sort of national endeavour mindset, I think. And we're not quite there yet.
No. Well, hopefully we will be soon. But anyway, I think if we could conclude a very interesting chat now at this stage, that would be great. Calling for a national endeavour, I think that's something that we can both agree on.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming on, Steve. Really good to see you again.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Ian.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Warships Pod, and I'd like to draw your attention to our latest edition, which is the March 2026 magazine, and in it we have all manner of exciting features and excellent photographs, and include among our menu of stories, we have something on the campaign to turn up the heat on Russia's shadow tankers and those of other rogue nations, the UK sending its only operational submarine to Australia, and the latest naval element of pressure on Iran. There's also an article on fears for British defence credibility and something about the French carrier group deploying, and two articles relating to the American bid to bring Greenland under its control, and a whole lot more besides. And it's worth noting that if you want to know more about the Royal Navy, all the various elements of its fleet, and also various topics that relate to it, plus also see some amazing photography and ship stats, etc., then please take a look at and invest in our Guide to the Royal Navy 2026. Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook, and in both cases that's at Warships IFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at Warships IFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.